Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Al Bernstein Unplugged Unboxing. In a 40-year Hall of Fame career, Al has chronicled some of the greatest moments in boxing history. On this podcast, you get to hear him expand on those memories and talk about the current news in the sport of boxing. You also hear Al interview some of the biggest names in the sport. Here's Al Bernstein Unplugged.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to our show. On this one, we're going to have a slightly different format. We are guestless, and that's kind of by design. We decided that we were getting so many questions from all of you, sending us questions on Twitter, at Al Bernstein, my handle, that we wanted to dig into as many of those questions as we could. We don't always get to all of them. And so on this show, in addition to Tripp and I chatting a little bit about boxing, we're going to answer a lot of your questions. And the gentleman I just alluded to is my friend, cohort, and co-host, Tripp Mitchell. Tripp, how are you doing today?
I am doing great, and so excited about you and the whole Showtime crew doing the fight a little while ago. And you did a twin pay-per-view, which has never been done before. You were on the air for, what, 6 hours? That's incredible.
Yes, it was. At some point on the broadcast, I wanted to say, okay, Ed McMahon, let's take a look at the tote board. and for our younger viewers, that's a reference to the Jerry Lewis telethon for MDS that he used to do. It was a long stretch, I have to say, but it was fun. We had a good time and the boxing was good. And it was an interesting evening for sure.
Well, and the reviews of the fights themselves, the Charlo brothers are getting great PR right now. Well, not PR, but just commentary on their boxing, yeah. How strong they are. Have you ever seen another pair of brothers like this? Who would you bring up?
Yeah, there have been other brothers. The Galaxy twins, KO Galaxy and his brother. He was a great, I think, featherweight champion many, many years ago from the Philippines. And there have been other brothers that have been champions. The Galaxy twins were twins, as the Charlos are twins. And there have been brother combinations that have been good in boxing, not so much both champions. But the Charlos are starting to really gain traction. You know, they wanted to deliver good performances, and they did. You know, the Jermall Charlo fight with Sergey Derevianchenko was really an excellent performance by him. Not so much that he won, but the way he won. Derevianchenko had good moments in this fight. You know, he won, in my opinion, he won 4 rounds in this fight. It's one of the scorecards, two of the scorecards had it a little wider. Our own unofficial score, Steve Farhad had it 116-112. That's where I would go for this fight. There were 4 rounds where Derevianchenko won. And when that fight ended, Sergey was attacking Jermall Charlo and having good success. So, you know, he took on a tough fighter and rightfully got a tough fight. But for the most part, he controlled the action. He landed big power punches. It's astonishing to me on a couple of occasions from those right uppercuts that he was throwing that Derevianchenko did not go down. That was amazing to me and shows his toughness. And so for him, unfortunately, now his third chance at missing out on the middleweight championship. But for Jermall Charlo, cementing his place as an excellent fighter. And for Jermall, the performance was even more dominant against Jason Rosario, who himself had two of the 154-pound belts. And Jermall Charlo knocked him down in the very first seconds of the fight with kind of a wild left hook, would score another knockdown, and then ended the fight with, of all things, a jab to the solar plexus. And he took the wind out of Rosario completely, and he did not beat the count. And in fact, even went to the hospital for observation, but he's fine now. He went back to the Dominican Republic, and he's doing well, which we're all happy about. But it was, they provided the kind of dominant performances that they wanted to kind of cement their place as important players on the boxing landscape.
Which division is stronger to you, junior middleweight or middleweight right now?
I think junior middleweight is stronger. You know, it has a plethora of good fighters. There's Jermell Charlo, of course, J. Rock Williams, Erickson Lubin, Jared Hurd, Arislandi Lara, Brian Castaño, Teixeira, the WBO champion, who's pretty good. And I think in terms of, and plus Rosario, who we still can't count out of the picture, there are a lot of good 154 pounders. So I think that division probably is up there. The other division that's great is one that we featured on the pay-per-view, the 122 pound division, where Danny Roman won, although I thought it was a much closer fight than the judges felt. And he is going to likely get a title shot again. He was former unified champion of that division. Louis Nettie, who came in with a reputation as a giant knockout artist with 11 straight knockouts in a row, couldn't get a knockout against Aaron Alameda, but did win the fight. He could either fight Roman, or he might fight Brandon Figueroa, who had a great fight against Damian Vasquez. Vasquez fought the fight of his life, a young 23-year-old who came in a big underdog. He fought really well for about six rounds, and then the aggressiveness of Figueroa, who throws over 100 punches a round, really took over.
Okay. Well, as mentioned, we have gotten some great questions, and today's show is, I'm excited because we get to ask a lot of them.
A lot of them, and some of them, not the easiest ones.
No, there was a little hostility on,
there's a little edginess on these days among boxing fans on Twitter. So we will meet it head on, not necessarily directed at me, but just in general. And we'll do our best to deal with it.
Okay. This one comes from Adrian. No, this is not from Adrian Broner. Excuse me. This comes from PDS. How would you rate Jermall to do against the 90s middleweights like Tony, Julian Jackson, or Gerald McClellan?
Well, that was a fascinating question. You know, that middleweight era was a great one. And I announced a lot of James Toney fights. James Toney at his absolute best would be an interesting and little bit difficult matchup for Jermall Charlo because he's so good defensively. But if Charlo stayed on the outside against him, as he did against Derevianchenko, and didn't attack, overcommit, he could actually win that fight staying on the outside, I believe. But it would be a very tough fight. That one is that's a pick'em fight to me. I think James Toney is overall, at his very best, when he's totally in shape, is one of the best fighters of the last 50 years. But there's a certain stylistic element to that fight that I think kind of helps Charlo a little bit and makes it a more even fight than it might be. So that one would be difficult. Julian Jackson, I think, would have a problem against Charlo because Charlo has an amazing chin. And Julian Jackson was a big puncher, but he was also susceptible to big punchers. And so I think I would lean toward Charlo in that fight. Gerald McClellan is an intriguing one because he would do what Derevianchenko did in parts of the fight. That is, get inside and work the body of Jermall Charlo. If he didn't get knocked out early in the fight, he might have done some good things against him. And then there was also I think those are fighters that would make for great matches with Jermall Charlo.
Well, fantastic. And it's fun when you go from eras, because again, that's makes your job a lot more interesting, because there's no right or wrong on that. But having seen all these boxers and called all these fights, you're one of the best guys to get this information.
In
Next
theory,
question.
We hope.
Graham Buckle. What do you think of Tim Tszyu from down here in Australia?
Yeah, that's the son of Costa Tszyu, who, of course, I announced Costa Tszyu's last fight when he fought Ricky Hatton and lost to Ricky Hatton in Manchester, England. And that was an extraordinary night on every level. But, of course, most of Costa Tszyu's career was a successful one. He was one of the best. He's a Hall of Famer and one of the best 140-pounders that ever lived. His son, Tim, making his way as a fighter. And I think Tim Tszyu is going to be a really, really good fighter. I think he's on the verge of contention, and I believe he's going to be fighting contenders very shortly. So I think he's going to have an excellent career.
And it must be fun for you to see the next generation come along, and that happens a lot in boxing.
It does. Yeah, it really does. And in fact, we see it happening in so many different sports, right? In the NBA and baseball. Baseball especially, for some reason, it's just a regular happening. And it is fun to see a next generation come. It also reminds you how old you are, though.
That's Thanks, the bad Al, part. For noticing the downside.
Yeah.
Okay, this is the question that had a little edge to it from Corey. Why do commentators feel it's necessary to have to speak every second of the fight?
Yeah, that's a fair question. You know, there are some elements to that. I mean, I try not to do that, but here's the point. Even if I try not to do that, most broadcast groups are now three-man booths. That adds to that situation because you have three people there who, even if they lay out, when they speak, that's part of the round where you're hearing a voice. So it's not always about announcers being verbose. It's about how many of them are doing the telecast. However, I would agree with Corey. We live in an age where sportscasters talk too much. It's a fact. On every sport, every single sport. One time I was doing a fight years ago, and I won't mention the broadcaster, but he was a play-by-play person who literally was filling up every second. And the producer of the show made this caustic comment to him. He said, "Could you give natural sound a chance?" And that's what Corey's saying, give natural sound a chance. And I really agree with him. And we do our best to try and monitor ourselves on our broadcast. Sometimes we succeed more often, sometimes we fail. But it has become a norm in sports and part of the problem too is that people have conversations. And if you're having a conversation, you're always talking. Now, we don't do that so much on our show. We don't have a lot of conversation. There is byplay between us. But we're not going to sit there and discuss the 154-pound division while the fight's happening. Some people do that in basketball, football, baseball. It's the norm now. So I'm with Corey, though, and I want to be part of the solution, not the problem. I try to be, but it's an issue.
So during the fights during the pandemic with no crowd versus having a big crowd, is it more important in your opinion to talk less with no crowd or talk less with a crowd?
It's a very good question. And Mauro even alluded to the fact that at some point during the broadcast, he said, you know, and we paused for a little bit, and he paused. He said, you can hear the punches, which you can. You literally can hear the punches. The temptation is probably to talk more because you don't have the crowd as an element. So when natural sound is happening, usually it's partially the crowd and partially other things, which makes it more interesting than the kind of silence you have now other than those punches landing. So it does place a challenge on broadcasters not to talk all the time.
Yeah, and just on a personal level, when you watch basketball now with the crowd noise and hockey with the crowd noise, does it seem fake to you? Would you rather not.
I actually don't mind it. I don't know how you feel. It doesn't bother me. They kind of stick it in underneath a little bit. I know it's canned, but, and yet after a while I forget it's canned. So I don't know. Does it bother you?
It does. And it just,
I could see it going either way.
Yeah. The guy with his keyboard, you know, playing the sound.
Yeah.
But
deciding what's exciting and what's not. I get that both ways.
Yeah. And we don't think that boxing is going to get to the point where we have canned audience, I hope.
Well, I think there is on Fox, if I'm not mistaken, they may have put some sound in. I can't remember. Okay. I should know that, but I can't remember.
Well, Showtime is authentic. That's what we want to mention.
Oh, we're trying to be.
Okay. This comes from Fight Fan. What's next for Jermell Charlo?
Yeah, here's so Erickson Lubin on August 19th or September 19th on our Showtime Championship Boxing beat Terrell Gachet. So as in a mandatory title elimination fight in which the winner would fight the WBC champion, which could have been either Rosario or Charlo, depending on who won. And of course, Charlo did. So if Jermell Charlo wants to keep the WBC title, he now also owns the WBA and IBF title, he would have to fight Erickson Lubin. Now, he has beaten Erickson Lubin already. He knocked him out in one round, a few years ago. Erickson Lubin has since matured, and he feels he's ready for a rematch with Charlo. So that is one fight that's open to him. The 154-pound division has a number of different options for him. I mentioned a lot of the fighters before. And Patrick Teixeira is the WBO champ. He might want to try and unify and get all of the titles.
By the way, now with the TV networks controlling different fighters, is there a solution for that? Because, you know, for instance, the Charlos now, both brothers might be top 10 pound for pound, but there's a lot of great fighters that they might not see because the other fighters are on different networks. How do you get past that?
Well, yeah, for Jermell, it's less of a problem because of the promotional thing. Even though they have fought on both Fox and Showtime, both of them, but those networks get their source of their boxing from Premier Boxing Champions. For Jermell Charlo, almost all of the 154 pounders are within the PBC family. That's why he's been able to fight more of the contenders than Jermall Charlo has, because a lot of the middleweight, Canelo is off on the zone and we don't know what promoter he's with now, depending on the lawsuit that he has. But Golovkin's off with a different, with DAZN, Demetrius Andrade is over there. And so for Jermall Charlo, that's an issue. I think boxing is, you know, some of those have started to be solved with Bob Arum and the ESPN folks making combined pay-per-views with Fox. And you can do it more on the pay-per-view level. If you have a fight that's on a pay-per-view level, it's a little tougher, though it's been done with fights that are less than pay-per-view. But we're all hoping that can be conquered a little more in boxing. We're seeing some signs of chipping away at that.
That's fantastic, because it used to be promoters caused a lot of headaches and wanted to keep all the money for themselves. And now boxing can certainly use some great matchups.
Well, and you know, back in the 80s when everybody was fighting on over-the-air networks, nobody had an exclusive with the network. You'd see some fighter on CBS, but then 9 months later, you'd see them on the ABC Wide World of Sports. And then maybe 2 years later, you'd see them on NBC. So the networks weren't, you know, involved. I think, to be perfectly candid, when the premium networks, HBO and Showtime, got involved, the promoters made more, they did more exclusivity with certain networks.
Yeah. And just, this is a little inside, but why do you think HBO got out of boxing?
I think it was their source of material was kind of fights was drying up a little bit. And I think they didn't have places to go for their product as much as they wanted. It just turned out other, some of the promoters had gone with other networks, and pretty soon, whether it was due to them not quite planning properly or just a quirk of fate and a circumstance they couldn't control, they were ending up with a situation where they weren't going to have the kind of product that they would want to make their subscribers happy with their boxing. And, you know, in premium networks, it's about whether you're, you know, when they do all those subscriber, surveys.
Okay, questionnaire, sure.
That's when questionnaires and surveys, that's when, if people keep telling you, I like the boxing, then you keep having the boxing. If all those people tell you they don't, then you're tempted not to have it. Now, I don't think that happened at HBO, but I think what happened, and this is just from my outside knowledge of it, I think it was partially the lack of product that wasn't available to them.
And so you were able to be on HBO for the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight, so. You know, you had your one.
Well, I worked with HBO broadcasters. Yeah, and yeah, I was on there. Although you wouldn't have known the way I was introduced, but that's another question. I won't get into that. But the way the introduction went on the actual HBO portion of the broadcast was not shared of me. It wasn't shared with the same enthusiasm and grace that we extended to our colleagues on HBO. That's another.
So, did you think you were in the witness protection program at one point?
It was a little bit like that, but that's okay. But I was on there, and I've been on HBO some other time. So, I'm happy with that.
Okay, that sounds great. Kevin McIntyre, with a quick question: watch the fantastic documentary that is on Sonny Liston. Just curious about what your thoughts about this poor guy's life.
Yeah, Sonny Liston, you know, had a hard scramble life that included a stint in prison and some difficulties, you know, along the way. He was able to rise to become heavyweight champion. Even that was not easy. He was frozen out by the people around Floyd Patterson from getting his opportunity. Once he did, of course, he twice knocked out Patterson, became champion, and then lost to Muhammad Ali twice. And also there, of course, there are the Sonny Liston mob connections. There are his drug issues. And there are many, many years ago in the early 80s, I wanted to write a book about Sonny Liston. And I used to have lunch every time we did our weigh-in, I would have a breakfast / lunch with some of the old timers in Vegas. Mel Greb, who was a great matchmaker, Bob Martin, a great handicapper, Jack Franz, also a handicapper. And by the way, I thought these guys were having lunch with me because I was, you know, a young guy on announcing the fights, and they enjoyed my company.
Witty banter.
And maybe that was part of it, but I'm pretty sure now that Jack and Bob Martin were really just kind of picking my brain to see who they should bet on the ESPN fight. So in retrospect,
knowledge.
I'm not sure it was my sparkling personality that they wanted.
Who bought lunch? That's the question. Who paid for it?
Anyway, when I used to have lunches with them, I mentioned at one point that they kind of started to, you know, they liked me, and they were kind of Dutch uncles to me. And I mentioned that I wanted to do the book on Sonny Liston. And I'll never forget Mel Greb reaching his hand over to me and putting his hand on my, you know, right here on my arm and saying, "No, don't do that." And I said, why do you think? He said, "Don't do it. It's too early for you to do it. Too many people are still alive, and you don't want to try and write that book right now." And I took that, and Bob Martin and Jack Franzi told me exactly the same thing. I didn't write the book. And there have been, you know, now things written and done about them, but their point was there were too many people alive that wouldn't want you things written about them. And if you accidentally did too good a job of researching that book, you'd be in trouble. So Sonny Liston, you know, it was a troubled life, and, you know, he, it was he reached the top of the heavyweight division, but it was a struggle, and his reign as titleist did not last long.
So these guys were implying that the people that were still alive were not necessarily Garden Club members?
Right. And once you got to the death of Sonny Liston, yeah, you might hear from them in a way that you didn't want to hear from them.
So, you know, you in your book, by the way, we haven't done a plug for it lately, but wonderful book, 30 years, 30 undeniable truths about boxing, sports, and TV. And you have more great stories in there about fighters. And but speaking of running into people you don't want to, you have told this story before, but I love it. The gentleman in Cape Cod Coliseum who stood up next to you at the urinal. Can we do that one more time?
Yeah, that was a crazy story. What had preceded it was that there had been a blackout at the fight, which some people thought might have been dubious, that maybe one of the local promoter caused the blackout because his fighter wasn't doing well. When the lights came back on, people were fighting, and a lot of them had consumed quite a bit of alcohol, and it was crazy. And I went into, after the show was over, I went into the bathroom there. I was standing at a urinal, and a gentleman comes in dressed all in black leather with chains, and he comes next to me, kind of looked like an Italian mobster of some kind, right, or a would-be Italian mobster, and reached into his pocket and pulled a very big handgun out and put it right on top of the urinal. Oh, and he went to the urinal right next to me, even though there were other urinals available.
That's always a no-no.
Yeah. When I saw him pull the gun out and put it on the top, I looked down and I was somewhat startled. And he looked over at me and said, so what did you think of the fight? And I said, what would you like me to think of the fight? He started laughing, right? And we had a very brief conversation. I was hoping to get away from the urinal as soon as possible, but I was kind of in the middle of doing my business and I couldn't. He finished before me, strangely enough. He took the gun and then I was done, and he put it back in his pocket, and as he's walking out, he said to me, be careful out there, there's a lot of crazy guys out there. And he laughed. And I wanted to say, you know what, you're a little late with that warning. So yeah, that was one of the nutty things. And yes, I do tell that story in my book. So I think there are some stories I missed, and I'm seriously thinking now of doing part two. We'll make it 40 years and 40 undeniable truths.
Okay, perfect. And we joke with Wes before we go on the air that Wes was 11 when you talk about him in the book, and now he's 21 years old. So
right, yeah. So it's been a while. That's right. He was 11 or 12 years old, and he was a very different guy than he is now. Now he's almost a grown man.
Well, and you've talked about when you were inducted in the Boxing Hall of Fame back in New York, that Wes had a chance to meet Marvin Hagler, Sugar Ray, all these Tommy Hearns, and just loved it.
Right. Well, the interesting thing was Wes was not, and still is not, a major boxing fan or sports fan. He's as some people know, he's a very talented singer-songwriter, and the arts are more his thing. And as I pointed out, if you mention the word Oscar to him, he thinks Academy Award, not De La Hoya. Back then he was already doing acting. He had been acting. He had in theater and in other venues. And we were going to go to the Hall of Fame. And I said to him, I said, you're going to meet a lot of people. Oh, and we had been to another Hall of Fame that I was inducted in. And he came with us. And one of the former ex-champions, I think it was Bone Crusher Smith, looked at him and said, hey, show me your stance. Well, he had no stance, of course. But just by seeing what boxers done, he kind of came into a boxing stance. And I was really impressed. I was like, I didn't even know you ever saw a boxer. And I said, that was a very good performance. And he said, yeah. He said, I'm an actor. So when we were going to the Hall of Fame, I said, you're going to meet a lot of people. I said, I just want to tell you, some of these people are really, really famous, even though you might not know about them. Well, sure enough, we in the hotel where we were staying, there's Tommy Hearns and Marvin Hagler and Sugar Ray Leonard were all on the same floor. And they in this little tiny, they put you in this tiny little, in Canastota, a little, it's like a Motel 6. It really is a small little thing. And so you're always around the people that you're seeing. And then there's a little hospitality suite there also. And so he was rubbing elbows with and got to be like friends with Tommy Hearns and Marvin Hagler and Sugar Ray Leonard. And they were also friendly with him and they had fun with him. And he had a really nice, fun personality, which he still does. And so he was great with them. And at one point I said to him, I said, you know, those guys that you're, you know, he said to me at one point, he said, man, he said, those are nice guys. I really like them. I said, do you know at all who they are? He said, I know they were famous, right? I said, yeah. I said, there's about 10 million, you know, 13-year-olds out there who would really love to be who you are right now, hanging out with them. So he had fun with Uncle Marvin and Uncle Tommy and Uncle Ray.
That's perfect. And by the way, because Wes is going into the music business, tell him to remember that stance, because, you know, every once in a while, a quick poke in the head to a promoter or a record company guy makes life better, I think.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, right. That's right. I mean, I'll remind him, use the jab.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. And then Apple Secure with a question. Here's one. How come you recycle names that lost to someone with a big name in boxing as if the loss makes them great? Boxing stats are void. Stop with the pound for pound arguments, fighting twice a year. Told you, fakes. So this is the one that's out there a little, had a little edge on it.
Yeah, well, and he also mentioned fighters in there. I think, didn't he put Dervianchenko and
Gamboa, Jeff Horn, Kelly
Horn, and yeah, and I pointed, I actually sent a tweet back, and then I said I was going to answer it on here. The thing is, of course, to some degree, some of what he's written there is accurate. Sometimes people get recycled as opponents when they shouldn't, but you can't lump them all together like Sergey Dervianchenko. It was perfectly good to have him fight, Charlo. He had lost by split decision twice for the middleweight championship and showed us in the Charlo fight that he's still a very good fighter. I doubt that he will ever win a world title at this juncture at age 34, but he really fought parts of that fight very well. Now, in MMA, they are very conscious that somebody that loses a couple of fights should not be discarded. And oftentimes those people come back to make exciting fights. And that's where this gentleman is correct, but he's also partially wrong. If somebody makes exciting fights, they should be allowed to have several losses and still be put into good fights. And that's what mixed martial arts has done. And that has helped them. You know, boxing can become too reliant on having the O next to your name. He is right that sometimes in boxing, we do recycle. It's kind of like baseball managers, right? Or football coaches. Sometimes
sure, they all befuddled. Same guys get hired, yeah.
Right. They've had losing records at three places, and now they still get another job. And some young coach that might do better doesn't get a chance. So there's truth in what he says, but we have to be very careful not to overreact and generalize. And say, just because you have several losses, you can't still fight for a title. Now, Kell Brook is an interesting example. Many people believe Kell Brook is pretty much on the end of things. There are fighters that Kell Brooks can fight. They're talking about him fighting Bud Crawford. I don't know if Bud Crawford is somebody he can perform well against. That's a good question. There are other welterweights that he can, or 154 pounders. I just don't know if Bud Crawford is one of them.
Yeah. And, it's funny, just to follow up on that, in your book, you talked about a fighter who would go, he'd fight a couple, he was America's, you know, in the entertainment, you had America's guest on TV. This guy was America's opponent, where he would go anywhere, anytime, fight, change his name if he needed to.
And, oh, yeah.
And was, those characters.
Was Bruce DeMoss Strauss. He was an opponent, official opponent. That's what he did. And he was just good enough where he could win. He won like 50% of his fights, you know, which in boxing is not great, but he didn't throw fights. He just was overmatched frequently. And he used to say his job was to make sure, if you had a young prospect, you bring me in. If he can't beat me, cut your losses, because he should beat me. And there were times when he'd beat those prospects because he was trying. There was a fight that I did for Sports Vision in Chicago, and Bruce was on it, and it was one of the ones he won. He fought the entire match with his back against the ropes right above our broadcast position. And I mean almost 100% of the fight. And he would counterpunch off the ropes, and he ended up winning this 8-round fight. And I said to him afterwards, I said, Bruce, I said, Mouse, why did you fight in that one spot? He said, oh, Al, you know I love you. He said, I wanted to hear your commentary.
A truer answer. Never been given in the sport.
I'm like, thank you. I appreciate that.
Have you ever had a situation where a fighter listens to you, or maybe a trainer, and you'll be harping on something during the round, and then the trainer will tell the fighter to do what you said?
Well, that's probably happened. I don't know. I doubt that they're hearing me, though, because, I think mostly you can't hear the announcer unless you're right near them. But it is possible. I don't know. And I don't know if I should take credit for that anyway. I'm not sure. Not sure my commentary is that insightful, but sometimes maybe it's helpful. But, I don't know. It's a good question. Well, now, of course, in this current situation, I don't know, but that they can't hear us commentating. I haven't gotten like complaints about that, because that would be distracting. Because I know we can hear them, better in the corners, and they have to whisper a little bit more, because across the way the other guy could maybe hear them talk if they're too loud.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. Things are different, but as usual, when you send out a request for questions, we get some great ones. Thanks to everyone.
We did indeed. Did we complete our duties there?
We did.
All right, very good. So that was fun. I'm glad we got a chance to do that. Now, we will next week return with a vengeance with a guest, because we're going to have a great guest. Teofimo Lopez is going to join us, and that will be during the preparation week for his fight with Vasily Lomachenko. And that, of course, is a fight that we are all very, very much looking forward to and very excited about. And we'll get to talk to this young man who has just been an exciting and often flamboyant fighter with great power, and at a young age now getting a chance to challenge what many believe is the best pound for pound fighter in the world today. So it's going to be a lot of fun, and you and I will be here for it. My thanks to Tripp for his fine work on this, and Lee producing for Let's Do Something Productions. And we will see you next time.